morning, ladies and gentlemen. Philip Newbury here with another Ask the Expert. And joining me in the studio, we have Elaine Von Cannon, Associate Broker, ARB, SRES Notary, Residential and Commercial Real Estate Property Manager. And she is with Coldwell Banker Traditions. And we also have with us Kevin Onizuk, Branch Manager with J.G. Wentworth Home Lending. And we have a special guest with us today, Mr. John Stark of Centurus Financial Incorporated. And Mr. Stark is a registered principal and an investment advisor. And they are here to answer your questions on buying or selling real estate. Well, good morning, Elaine and Kevin and John. And what are we going to talk about today?
Morning, everyone. We are going to talk about today is real estate as an investment, but this is different than what we've talked about before. I had an interesting call 2 weeks ago about an IRA and putting real estate in an IRA for one of my investors. So I invited Mr. Stark to join us and to start the show with talking about an IRA and what kind of IRA does one need to put in real estate and what type of real estate.
Well, this is very interesting. Kevin, can a person have a mortgage on real estate that is in IRA?
That is a great question, Philip. And the answer is kind of yes, kind of no. From the mortgage side, we're going to treat every purchase the same. It is an individual making the purchase. They would not be able to purchase it and deed it in the name of the IRA. They would have to purchase it and deed it in their name. Now, they can certainly use funds for closing from the IRA. So say you get a mortgage and you put down a down payment. Say you decide to put a 20% down payment. You can get those funds from your IRA if the IRA allows it. There may be certain tax implications and penalties, which John can probably speak to better than I can. I am not a tax or financial advisor. I just know everything there is to know about mortgages. But from that side, you can certainly utilize those funds. You can't title it in the name of the IRA, but I'm not exactly sure how that then impacts it as an investment and being part of your IRA. Mm. And that's why we have Mr. Stark here to help us out today.
Well, Elaine, would you like to comment?
I will after Mr. Stark tells us what he needs to tell us, and because I do have a few questions.
Well, I'd like to say, first of all, thank you all for having me here today.
Good to see you.
There are a lot of pros and cons of utilizing an IRA in purchasing real estate. And we'll go over the, what I think some of the good parts of it and then what I think is some of the negatives of it. It's basically, it has to be a self-directed IRA, first off. It's basically you direct it yourself, and there's only a few custodians that allow that. Not every traditional brokerage community or any bank allows that. So there's only a special few custodians that allow it to have a self-directed IRA. Number one is you have to use the funds to purchase real estate that is actually an arm's-length transaction. I believe Kevin just talked on it. Basically, it's real estate that you cannot use for your primary home or the primary home of your immediate family or your children or their relatives. So basically, it has to be an arm's-length transaction. It has to be the conventional investment in rental property.
So, John, you're saying it has to be just an investment property.
Totally. Number two is when you do that, is all the funds, like Kevin talked about, have to be come out of the IRA to purchase it. But one of the downside of it is that within that situation is all the revenues that come, which are the rental incomes, they actually are paid into the IRA, which is one thing. And number two is that if you should need a repair, and in many cases, if you're buying a duplex, a quadplex, or something multifamily, and you need a new furnace, a new boiler, a new HVAC system, or a new roof, all those funds themselves have to come out of the IRA. So that's another disadvantage. You cannot have an external source. So if you don't have enough cash in that IRA at the time, you could be in a bad situation because you're not allowed to add to it to make the repair. Some of the disadvantages, again, of a self-directed IRA is the fact that is all the income comes into the IRA, and when a time comes when you sell the property and it is sold, it is actually sold and the funds go back into the IRA. traditionally, in most real estate, if it's held after a certain period of time, the transaction is treated as a long-term capital gain. However, as you know, when you take funds out of an IRA, whether you do it at 59 and a half, which is the minimum age, or 70 and a half when it's mandatory, that funds come out at your earned income rate. So traditionally, many times that's at a higher tax rate. So you do lose the disadvantages of long-term capital gain investing in some higher
things. John, let's clarify this. You're saying to our listeners that when you take it out, even though if it's mandatory, at the mandatory age, that they will still have to pay capital gains?
No, they'll be when they take the money out of an IRA, it is treated at your earned income rate. It's basically your tax rate where you are at the time, which is adjusted tax rate.
So if you're still working at 70,
and you're working at and you're making an income that's above certain levels, yes, you could be in a higher tax rate than conventional long-term capital gains tax.
That's interesting. Mm.
Wow.
You got some more for us?
Well, I think that it is a lot of, and then Kevin will address this situation, it is a lot more to do with a normal self-directed IRA with real estate. If you have a large amount of cash that is sitting idle, and I mean cash that's not invested, that's sitting idle in an IRA, and you want to use it to purchase real estate, go ahead, but you need to have that reserve that's not being used, that's not invested, so that you can actually have quick access to make that repair to the property or address that situation. So basically, every investment that's done this, everything has to come totally out of the IRA, and all the money goes back into the IRA. So once it's in, and that's the way it works on that situation.
So, John, you're saying if you needed to put in $500 into the property for a new stove or something of that nature, it has to come from the IRA?
Directly, yes, sir.
Interesting. So it does have to be kind of a unique IRA that would be very liquid and be able to get funds in and out very quickly.
Very liquid and very quickly done, and that's why only a few custodians allow to use a self-directed IRA that allows you to put real estate in, purchase real estate within the confines of the IRA.
Now, John, how would that work for title insurance? Say Kevin bought a house, had it in his IRA, and say that there was an encroachment from the neighbor, and so he had to use, you know, a fence encroachment or a driveway encroachment, and he had to use his title insurance, you know, that he purchased at the time when he purchased the property. Who enforces that? Does the IRA custodial have to enforce that, or what? How does that work?
The IRA is essentially the custodian that holds the asset. But if you had to use your title insurance, that becomes the part of the property owner itself, which goes back to, like Kevin said, it's titled in your name, but it is a rental property. So if you had to use your title insurance, you would, for an encroachment and deal with it, you would have to deal directly yourself. The IRA would not be involved with that. The IRA is only involved with the actual collection and distribution of the income of the IRA itself. As far as daily activities, that's up to the investor. And again, I must address, it will be investment property. It has to be an arm's length transaction.
Hmm. Well, John, a friend of mine has placed all his assets in an estate, including real estate. Is that better than a will? And if so, why?
I believe that if you use, in many cases, we use what they call a family living trust, or they actually can use a revocable or irrevocable trust to put real estate assets in. It has a benefit there that you can really be very specific within the trust and actually with the confines of what the trust assets are held. It is very good for purposes of many type of protection of the trust owning it, and it's actually the trust owns it and not the individual person. Whereas a will is just conveying your assets at your demise to somebody down the road. You can be very specific in a will, but a trust gives you a little bit more protection, very similar to putting a piece of real estate in an LLC, which I have encouraged people over the years to do for various forms of protection.
How would that affect the mortgage? How would that affect Kevin lending on that? Can an estate get a mortgage?
Well, it's up to the lender. Sometimes they can, sometimes they can't. And I know it's just like borrowing money from a lender. Sometimes they still want the estate listed, but the co-borrower will be the individual person as securing it. So it depends how the lender likes to address that situation.
Right. We will do mortgage lending, as we said, to individuals, deeded in as individuals. There are instances where a property can be held in a trust versus deeded in the individual's name, but not necessarily in the estate, because the estate would not typically have income for qualifying. And if it did, it wouldn't be based on an individual person. So if an estate were to get a loan like that, they would have to do some sort of other type of business or commercial financing, something more geared towards that. If an individual wanted to make a purchase or any sort of residential mortgage, it does have to be in the name of people, of actual individuals, or in some cases, a trust. And some alternative financing programs may be in an LLC. We do have those programs disappeared, but they are coming back, where an investor can purchase in the name of an LLC. A lot of investors will hold a property as a limited liability corporation to protect themselves, to protect some of their personal assets. You know, so those programs are not traditional financing. They're not the government-backed program, so they're a bit more expensive, but they are coming back to the marketplace.
Hmm. So, John, what do you see in the market as of now and for the end of the year?
Well, the financial markets, as this show is airing, have been very turbulent. We had one of the most turbulent months in quite a while in this last October. And we're seeing that come out from the reason of interest rates have just started to rise. The Federal Reserve has made a firm commitment to get the balance sheet in order, going back to the original TARP funds and the QE1 and QE2 back in 2008 and 2009. So therefore, an attempt to get the interest rates from what I call a more normal level, and I'm sure Kevin can address that, is that they're going to be raising the federal funds rate and the prime rate accordingly next year. The original plans we're hearing is as much as three or four times being raised. And so we are seeing that more often, more readily available now, is where rates are rising. And as a competition to equities, it's actually putting a damp on the stock market. So we'll wait and see what the market does for the rest of the year. Good thing is that earnings are still good for many corporations, and many of them in very good shape, and the prospects for business going forward, and with a low unemployment rate, it looks like we'll still have a stable market. But again, the market is volatile, and there are many exogenous events that can affect it.
Does weather affect it? Like, we've had the hurricanes, we've had these crazy storms, we have a fire in California.
Oh, I mean,
we have all kinds of terrible disasters going on, and non-disasters like shootings and stuff. Does all that impact the stock market?
Indirectly, it does. Let me put this back to the disasters. That does affect. As you know, hurricanes and some of the damages related to fires, hurricanes hit hard the insurers. And so many times the insurers and the reinsurers are exposed, and the stocks related to those sometimes are affected on that. So I would say, yes, weather can be a definitive situation, at least on a short term, depending on that. And also it causes many insurers to also have to raise rates and things that happen after that. So the bottom line is, yes, weather does have an effect, not so much on the stock market itself, but some on the individual companies and within the exchanges.
Well, last show, Kevin and I briefly and so briefly touched on a 1031. And that was one of the reasons I wanted you to come in today. I want you to expound your wonderful knowledge, and let's talk about 1031 tax exchanges.
All right, 1031, you related to, talked about, Elaine, is the section 1031 of the IRS tax code that basically says that a piece of property can be exchanged for another piece of property on a tax-deferred basis. Basically, if you own a piece of real estate and you may have bought 20 years ago, and say you bought a rental home that you paid $20,000 for first in 1995, and today it's worth, because of appreciation and good fortune, it's now worth $500,000. Well, normally speaking, you'll be having that appreciation, and you have to pay the capital gains tax and some other taxes related to and depreciation recapture.
Well, I'll be living in New Jersey.
And so the bottom line is you have those things. So bottom line is that therefore that Section 1031 allows you to take that property and exchange it for another piece of property and actually make that purchase with the same funds and not pay capital gains, which is a wonderful way to actually increase your wealth in real estate. That if it's done properly, you can actually defer it forever. And many people do what we call swap till you drop. is basically done that, because every time you swap, you get a increase in your cash basis, or rather your basis of the sale price, and when that goes forward, that can convey onto the next purchase. So if you do it properly, it's a very strong way to create wealth in buying real estate. But you have to be very specific in how you do it. I've been doing these specifically myself for about 20 years. And you have to follow the rules that are directed strongly by the IRS, which is basically, once you have a contract on a property and you have a closing, you have 45 days exactly to the hour to identify a replacement property of some sort. Mm-hmm. There are a number of methods of that. After that, you have 180 days total to make that exchange complete. And this is a ironclad rule. There's no thing around it. And if you wait to 181 days, guess what? The taxes have to be paid.
Now, when you identify, because you and I have done these before together, when you identify, that doesn't mean the people, it doesn't mean for people has to buy all 10 or 12 properties they identify.
No, there's several rules. One is the 200% rule, or 200% of the valuation of your 1031. Then you have the three property rule, and there's several rules about that. But basically being, when you want to identify, it's just you're going to name some properties that you may want to be purchasing as part of your exchange. Now, in addition to that, it is called a like-kind exchange. But that doesn't mean you can have, and so if you have an apartment house and you want to buy a nursing home, you can do that. Or if you have a building it could be used for a high-rise apartment, but you decide you just want single family, you can do that. You're not confined to any one type of real estate.
Or vacant land?
Or vacant land, too. But that, and many times we've had that with farmers, mm-hmm. who have large farms that were bought many years ago that are extremely valuable, and then maybe the heirs or the children don't want to continue with the farm, but the land's worth quite a bit. And we're able to help them sell it without having to pay the taxes and convey it on to the children. One of the things now that we have available is by utilizing a situation called a DST, which is a Delaware Statutory Trust. It allows us to actually select properties where you can actually buy a piece of a property that could be owned by a number of investors. An example is you might have a home you inherit from an heir that's been rented for a couple of years, and now it's worth a great deal of money, and you want to sell it. But you know it's going to be taxes involved. So you can actually sell, a home that your parents lived in, your grandparents lived in, that may be worth $500,000 or more, and you can buy that put that $500,000 in a Delaware statutory trust. And in a Delaware statutory trust is basically a program that can be anywhere from student housing for colleges. It can be medical office facilities. It could be multifamily. It could be shopping centers. And you could be a fractional landlord owner of these properties. But the good thing about that is it protects your money. You get an income from it. And many times we're finding when people are doing it successfully is that they're conveying a piece of farmland that produced very little income, is now they're conveying that into like a student housing property or a nice shopping center, and they're getting a nice return that's something they didn't get before, and they get also alleviate any capital gains taxes. So if it's done properly, but I must tell people when they do it, is please make sure you're doing it with somebody who knows what they're doing, because as when you get to closing, and as you've been to many closings, if you take constructive receipt, then the taxes become due. So make sure you have a third-party intermediary there, so when you sign a closing document, the funds never go in your hands. It goes to the third-party intermediary, which can be an attorney or a bank or whoever you choose, and a number of institutions that serve as third-party intermediaries.
Constructive receipt is just even one penny that you would take, as meaning any profit you would take out of there.
It
makes it null and void.
If you take that check at closing, and if you take $1 out of closing, it becomes constructive receipt, and then it's null and void, and therefore your 1031 exchange is dead.
And now I have something for Kevin I just thought about. Things pop in my head, Philip, and they out. It's like a popcorn popper.
It is, isn't it?
I have to say what it is when they come in.
Say it.
All right. Now, Kevin, John Stark has a house, and he just got it from his mother who passed away. Now, it has a mortgage on it. Can John keep paying that mortgage and it stays like it is, or as the lender, would that mortgage come due because the borrower dropped dead?
Technically, yes. It would come due if the borrower no longer exists. They are the one obligated on that mortgage. So the estate, whoever's in charge of the estate, would then want to contact the mortgage company, let them know of the situation, and make arrangements. Now, the mortgage company doesn't want that house back, so they may make arrangements where the estate can continue to make payments. Say if somebody from the family wants to take it over and just take over the mortgage, odds are they will encourage them to purchase it from the estate and go get their own mortgage on their own, because technically the person that is obligated on it is no longer alive. So that is really up to the mortgage company, and it is negotiable. But theoretically, it's possible to keep it open and keep making mortgage payments. But by the letter of the law and the deed and deed of trust you sign at closing, it comes due and something needs to be done with it.
Now, John, I have an interesting question for you. I have a client, and she has this aunt. And the aunt's a little
eccentric.
Different.
We'll say eccentric.
Yes, eccentric. And she owned a piece of property with her live-in husband, common-law husband, and they never married. He passed away. All right. His sister is the executor of his estate. But they have not went to the city to probate the will to get him off of it.
Let me first ask Elaine, how was the house titled at the time of the death?
It was titled in Mr. and Mrs. John Doe. Jim Doe and Jane Hill.
All right, so that's how the house is titled at the time of the death.
Jack and Jill went up the hill.
All right, at that point, when that happens, if it's titled that way, that is a point where you need to contact the local municipality and contact them and let them, they usually have a form there, and take a copy of the death certificate and say, hey, Mr. Doe is dead, or Ms. Hill is still alive, whatever, and then say, she is dead, I'm the sole survivor, and the way the title was. And if it's titled in joint with right of survivorship, that's all you have to do. It takes a little procedure to do it. You can get it done in a day. But any municipality will do where they'll do it for you. They have usually a form there. You sign it out, and usually do it without a fee. But you have to bring a death certificate to prove that one of the persons you were on with is now passed on.
Now, what happens is Aunt Hill
doesn't do it,
and she drops dead, and the sister, Penelope Pennywinkle, takes over.
It could well happen. If she doesn't go, because actually the title supersedes the will. It's just like a beneficiary situation. So definitely it has to be gone to the point where the title has to be gone, goes back to the original chain of command of the title. So the title has to be rectified, and that is going to the municipality letting know that one of the persons, but it was joint with right of survivorship, and the survivor's here and is alive with the deceased person's death certificate. And then once it's retitled, then it's hers. But if she doesn't do that and she passes, then it goes back to the original situation, and it goes back to the line of with the original, which was original owner predeceased her. It would go to the will and what it says there, so it could really be tied up to a number of heirs, depending on what that will says.
Kevin, can I get you in here for a moment? Any new loans that are here or coming that you would like to tell our listeners about?
Yeah, I want to hear this.
Hey, Phillip, we have our special guest today, so I'm more than welcome to sit and learn from him, especially when he talks about Delaware, because I'm a fighting blue hen, went to University of Delaware, and maybe I shouldn't say that in Griffin country here, but, you know.
Perhaps not, but you've said it now.
Yes. But no, I certainly love my Williamsburg. New loan programs you ask about. There is some pretty exciting stuff I'll touch on real quickly, because we are talking about a lot of investments right now. There's a lot of properties for sale in the market that we'll say need some love, some attention to get it to be a home that someone would truly be in love with. So we offer rehabilitation mortgages for investors. That is something fairly unique. It's more commonly available if somebody wants to purchase a home to live in it, to fix it up. But we will do a non-owner occupied, we call it, so a rental or investment property purchase with as little as 15% down, and fund additional money for improvements along with that mortgage.
That's so, new, Kevin, because before it had the owner occupied, didn't it?
Right. Yes. So it's kind of an exciting new product that we have, and it's been very popular. Investors really like it because it allows them to purchase and kind of help keep some of their cash flow to themselves. So you can use it for redoing a kitchen, replacing carpet. If you have a two-bedroom, two-bath, you can make it a three-bedroom, three-bath. Whatever you need that's reasonable for improvements to make that property what you want it to be. So that's pretty exciting. But what's even more exciting is right now we've got so much free money to give away, we don't know what to do with it. We have grant funds available primarily for first-time home buyers, but in some other cases.
Is that Virginia grant funds?
It is for Virginia. I only am licensed in Virginia, so
no, but
yes.
I mean, is that like a VHDA or USDA?
That's one of the options, yes. Okay. Yep, there are VHDA first time. That's the Virginia Housing Development Authority. That is one of the options, but we've got grant funds available for either down payment or closing costs. So if you want a lower no down payment type mortgage program, we have grant funds that you don't have to pay back for qualified individuals. And for folks doing a no down payment mortgage, such as a VA, if you are a veteran purchasing a home using no down payment, we'll give you a grant for your closing costs up to 2% of the purchase price to help cover your closing costs over and above what the seller's paying. And if the seller's paying all of your closing costs, you can use some of it to pay off your bills, pay down a car loan or a credit card to make the home purchase more affordable. So that's what we are most excited about for folks that are looking to purchase their home, especially first-time home buyers. We've got a lot of free money to help make it more affordable.
Now, okay, what is the rule of thumb, Kevin? It used to be that when you would do first-time home buyers, is it one that hasn't done it for like the first 3 years, or is that rule of thumb out?
Now, generally, you're considered a born-again first-time home buyer if you have not owned a home in the last 3 years. But there are programs, low and no down payment, even some grant funds for folks that are not first-time home buyers.
That's good to know.
It is.
Well, I want to thank our guests for being here this morning, and you can contact Kevin on his cell at 757-645-8996. Elaine Von Cannon, her cell number is 757-288-4685, and John, 804-306-5620. Well, I want to thank Elaine, Kevin, and John for another Ask the Expert, and I hope this has been a help to our listeners. Be sure to keep your radio tuned to FM 93.5 The Berg and WMBG AM 740 to find out when the next Ask the Expert will be broadcast. So, till next time, Philip Newbury here. Have yourself a great day. Cheers.